I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is digital curator for contemporary collections at the British Library. After graduating from Aberystwyth University with a degree in library studies and art history, my guest was awarded an MA in Museum Studies at the University of Leicester. Then, having worked as a curator of maps at the National Library of Scotland, in 2010 they joined the British Library and began to devise creative reuses of digital collections, including via video games. This work has led to collaborations with the National Video Game Museum, Adventure X, International Games Month in Libraries, and on research projects with UCL's Institute of Education and Lancaster University's Litcraft initiative, which builds literary worlds in Minecraft. Welcome, Stella Wisdom.
Can I correct something there?
Of course you can, yeah.
I joined the British Library in 2006.
2006, okay. Dan.
But I became a digital curator in 2010.
Okay, that's where I've got wrong. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. That's okay.
So Stella, you've got an amazing surname. Did you have a notoriously wise ancestor?
No, I think the only famous person I'm aware of with the surname Wisdom is Norman Wisdom, the comedian.
Right, yeah,
deceased now.
Not related then?
No. Well, there's not that many Wisdoms around, so it could be.
Yeah, amazing. You go back far enough, I'm sure. So tell us, I'm sure like listeners will be curious, what happens in a typical day in your job as curator of digital collections at the British Library?
I don't think there is a typical day. In fact, one of the things I most enjoy about my job is the variety. So my priority is to kind of promote innovative research using the library's digital collections.
Yes.
And also research, so kind of R&D, looking at how we collect complex digital and work with kind of born digital collections. Not quite sure what a typical day is in the life of a digital curator at the library, but it's kind of very varied.
Yeah. So I've been to the British Library like quite a few times. Amazing building in King's Cross. I'm assuming that's the only British library. There's not multiple.
We've got sites in Yorkshire, and when I first joined,
oh, you have,
yeah. When okay. I first joined the British Library, I was based at the Yorkshire site in Boston Spa.
Nice.
Kind of large complex of about 32 buildings.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So the library's collections are very vast.
Yeah.
And kind of we do have colleagues working at the site in the north as well as the site in the south.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, the only one I've been to is the one in King's Cross, and it's a hugely impressive building. It's always filled with people who are, I assume, sort of working on their, you know, students, university students working on stuff, and authors and things like that. And I've used the reading rooms there. It's fantastic. And there's this sort of massive multi-story bookcase.
The King's Library?
Is that what it's called?
Are you talking about the glass tower?
Yeah, that sort of runs up like a spine.
It is fantastic. So this is the glass tower. So for folks that haven't visited the British Library, this is a real kind of feature of the building. It's the King's Library. So it's filled with rare book collection that was basically left to the library. It's one of our foundational collections, and you can see the spines of the books through the glass. What's most exciting to me, though, is readers can request to see these books in the reading room. So occasionally, if you're very, very lucky, you see the shelves move and someone walk around with a trolley.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. And it's very obvious that it's a library because it's got that. You get to see it when you come in. But I wasn't actually aware that you had lots of digital artifacts in the library as well. So where are those kept, and how do people access them, and what kind of things are in there?
That's a good question. I suppose our biggest digital collection is probably the UK Web Archive.
Good.
So folks might not realise that we do an annual crawl of the UK Web.
Oh, really?
And we have what we call nodes at the British Library site, but also with the other national libraries in the United Kingdom, so National Library of Scotland and National Library of Wales. So we're talking servers, really, where digital collections are stored on servers, but then kind of backed up for digital preservation reasons.
Right. So if I wanted, I could go and see a snapshot of the internet from 2008 or something, but in the UK.
Yes, in our reading room. So if you were to come into our reading room, you could access the UK Web Archive and look at some, like you say, captures of sites going back. We've been Web Archiving for quite a while, but we're just celebrating 10 years of UK legal deposits, and where we've been kind of had a mandate to do Web Archiving for the nation. So yeah, it's pretty comprehensive and exciting.
Oh, wow. There's probably some articles I wrote around that time that I'd like to break in and delete from that archive, but
which
I guess that's not allowed.
That's probably not in the spirit of Web Archiving.
No, I suppose not. Oh dear. Well, and then you've obviously got the internet there, and I guess you've got digital versions of books and things like that. But do you also keep video games in that digital archive?
We've been collecting what we call emerging formats. So and some of these works other people might call a video game. So what we're kind of talking is maybe writerly games, interactive narratives, interactive fiction, these kinds of works. And in fact, In my job working with digital collections, what I've been trying to kind of understand is what might be scope for the library to collect under UK legal deposits. It is a bit difficult. I mean, you can start having kind of big questions of what's a video game or what's a book. And really, what we've been kind of looking at is some of these quite writerly interactive works that some people might want to call a book, and other people might want to call a video game.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of hard to pin them down.
Do you have to approach the IP rights holders for that? So like if you wanted to put a game that was developed in the UK, Grand Theft Auto or something, you wouldn't be able to do that because of legal reasons, or could you ask?
Grand Theft Auto is probably not the type of game that would be under scope for UK legal deposit because we're kind of looking at kind of writerly and narrative content.
Okay. They might contest that. Some of the writers on that game might say, this is literature.
Maybe. And I have been aware of filmmakers that have been doing some interesting experiments with Grand Theft Auto. With the types of works that we have been looking at and that we're featuring in the library's digital storytelling exhibition, which is open at the moment and runs to the 15th of October this year, we have been, with the works that we've been collecting, we have been working with the creators and the publishers to collect them. So under UK legal deposits, it's the same. People often say, does the British Library collect a copy of every book? And we can do, but we kind of we rely on the publishers to send us copies of these books. So it's the same with digital. So it's kind of working with the publishers to collect these works. We have got a right to collect publications. So if we're treating what some people might define as a video game as a publication, then we would have a right to claim it. But because we're kind of trying to understand how to collect and curate and preserve these types of works, it's definitely more meaningful to work with the creators and do it with their support and permissions. It's very much a kind of collaborative and kind of very respectful partnership work at the moment.
That's so super interesting. So, I mean, you know, lots of people who work in the games industry listen to this show. If anyone is, interested in getting in contact with the British Library to deposit their writing for games, is that something they can do? They can email you?
Yep, they can do. There is a legal deposit site on the British Library website, and that gives full details of how people can deposit their publications. So yes, do get in touch. We've also got a page for our emerging formats research, and I would imagine if it's someone in the kind of games industry with more experimental works, they would probably be best having a look at the emerging format page and contact them in that address. The game is on an interactive website, though. There is a nomination form for the UK Web Archive, so anyone can nominate a website. It's that's probably the best thing to do if something's on it, like say a browser-based game. And that's where we've had quite a lot of success collecting, actually, because of the technology for web archiving.
How interesting. Amazing. Well, Stella, I've asked you to pick the five video games that you would like to put on your very own fictional games machine and put out to the world. Could you start by telling us about your first game? What is it and why do you love it?
So starting with 80 Days. For folks that have not played 80 Days, this is a literary adaptation of Jules Verne's novel Around the World in 80 Days. The lead writer is Meghna Jain. This is a very, very wordy game. So one of the reasons I've kind of picked this, kind of, there's apparently the claim there's more words in this than kind of Tolkien. So
really?
So yeah, there's endless variations. So you get to play as Phileas Fogg's valet, Passepartout, and you travel the world. And obviously the aim is to travel around the world before 80 days and to win the wager.
No.
But you can... I don't know whether I'm quite a naughty player, because sometimes I've gone on real kind of detours and I know I'm not going to make it around the world in 80 days, but you end up with some quite interesting kind of things happening. The mechanics of the game are interesting. You can buy and sell objects when you go to different places. You can go to the bank and withdraw funds. You can talk to different people and have different encounters. And everything you do affects what routes open up and how quickly you're able to kind of travel or the different destinations that kind of open up. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's a spectacular game, absolutely. And like you say, it's... very literary as well. Meg, who was quite young when she wrote it, I think, but it's probably far longer than the actual novel on which it's based now, I would have thought, in terms of word count.
And we have displayed it alongside a printed copy of the novel in the library. So if anyone comes to the exhibition, we thought it was quite nice to display an actual edition of the printed novel next to the interactive game that it's based on. We've also printed out a map of the different options and journeys that you can do.
Oh, so cool.
So it's really fun. What I do quite like is obviously you have to keep Volk happy, and if you don't, I don't know, comb his hair or talk to him or keep him happy, that can kind of affect how things go as well. It's Yeah.
Yeah, lots of lovely details, isn't it? And a great idea to the perspective through viewing it through his valet rather than the typical protagonist. It's just fantastic, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me, Stella, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in Warwickshire, called Bedworth. Probably not many people have heard of it. I suppose it's near Coventry. That's probably the biggest place that Bedworth is near.
Yeah, village type vibes, was it?
It is a town. It's a small town.
And were you into sort of books and reading and maps and libraries and all that stuff when you were a kid?
I was. I was a bit of a nerdy child. I suppose it's stereotypical avoiding PE. I hated sports and PE.
Yeah.
And so I'd go and hide in the library. So I do look back on my school days and think, so libraries have always been a kind of place of refuge and sanctuary for me.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, they do have that feel, don't they? This is like a lovely smell in a library of all the books and hopefully nice and quiet as well. Was that your school library then that you were going to, or was there one in the village as well?
Bedworth had a library in the town. In fact, I'm so nerdy, I did my school work experience there.
Oh, you did? No way.
I did, and I do thank Bedworth Library for making me want a career working in libraries. I remember thinking I had a great time. They let me organise a Beatrix Potter party for children and curate a section on heavy metal and rock music for the teenage section. I had a blast. It was really fun. So that kind of put me on the path to wanting to work in libraries. But I never dreamed I'd end up at the British Library and working with complex digital collections.
Yeah.
That's not what I imagined when I was young.
That's so cool. When you do your Beatrix Potter party, and think you'd end up at the country's largest library. So good.
Absolutely.
And what role did video games play for you when you were a kid? Did you have a console or a PC or anything like that?
I'm quite old, Simon, so I don't want to totally confess how old I am, but I'm probably older than what you might think. So I had quite an analog childhood, but I didn't have a computer. I do remember computers being introduced into the classroom, but we're talking kind of early BBC computers. So because this was the 80s, so I was at school in the 80s. But some of my friends who I grew up with on the same street as me did have a Sega Mega Drive. So I would sneak around their house and play Sonic, and I was absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
But that was great fun. And so it was kind of really going around friends' houses. And it really was, like I say, I remember a lot of Mario and Sonic, but we're talking like early 90s in the times. Yeah.
Was your library one of those libraries in the 80s that had computers that you could go and play games on, or was it strictly books and cassettes?
I don't think it was definitely books and cassettes and music on CDs, but like I say, we're talking about the 80s and the People's Network hadn't arrived into libraries, so that's when they put internet in libraries. That happened when I was an adult.
Right, okay.
So I remember that happening. In fact, the internet was very new. So to put it into context, I went to university in 1996. And at the time, in the kind of mid-90s, I thought that every university had the internet. And it was only much later that I realised it. First of all, it was universities that had computer science departments.
Right.
So I had, like I say, quite an analogue and offline childhood just because of when it was. But then I was quite fortunate that I went to university when the internet was...
Just all kicking in.
It was all kicking in.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of kind of freedom to make websites and... being an information and library studies student, I did quite a lot of shared modules with the computer science department. So nerdy modules, systems analysis and systems design and that type of thing. But for me, it was kind of engaging in digital that was something that happened to me at university.
Right, yeah, interesting. Did you have a hankering to get your own games console then by the time you get to uni and PlayStation's out, I guess, and all of that kind of thing?
Didn't have the funds.
Sure.
Sadly.
Didn't squander your student loan on that instead of...
No, it's... I did used to go sometimes to some LAN parties. So I was a student in Aberystwyth, but actually Lampeter was probably our nearest other university. So sometimes I would go over to Lampeter and some folks I know would kind of have LAN parties around there. So again, it was going around other people's houses to play games rather than at home.
What were they playing? Sort of Doom kind of stuff? Or?
Definitely. It was those types of games, yeah.
Yeah, very nice. All right, Stella, let's come to your second game there, which is from 2017, I believe.
So my second game is See You Later by Dan Hett.
It's late. The house is quiet. The kids are asleep. You should be asleep too. You're not asleep. You are in bed, but, like every night, you're semi-autonomously scrolling through the infinitely replenishing feed of message and information through the glowing rectangle of your smartphone. You've read the articles. You know full well what artificial light and electronics does to your sleep, but the draw of the internet usually overrules that by some distance. Next to you is your wife, similarly engaged in her own distraction. Your eyes are starting to get tired, which you take as a signal to put the thing down and get some sleep. You're thinking about it when you notice a sudden flurry of activity on social media about something going on in the city.
This won the New Media Writing Prize in 2020. So I've picked this work because it's created using Twine. I'm very interested in Twine because it's open source, it's easily available. And I've done quite a lot of work with encouraging people to make their own interactive fiction using Twine.
Yeah, so just explain how Twine works for anyone, any listeners who don't know what it is.
So with Twine, that's a good question. With Twine, you can use it either in the browser or you can kind of download it and you can write your own interactive narratives. The interface looks a bit like a flowchart. So if anyone's pretty experienced of making kind of flowcharts or doing any kind of project management diagrams, getting to grips with Twine would be quite easy. But you can write your text and then create branching narratives. You can do all sorts of other complex things with Twine as well. There's lots of cookbooks and tutorials out there, but essentially it's kind of like a way to make hypertext narratives.
A bit like choose your own adventure, isn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely. And it's very kind of easy to pick up and have a go with. You can pick up Twine quite easily in a short workshop or just kind of playing around. But why I've picked See You Later, it's a very serious, thoughtful work. So Dan lost his brother Martin in the 2017 Manchester terrorist bombing, and dealing with his grief, he created a kind of a series of different types of games. And I must admit, before becoming aware of See You Later, I was aware of another work, The Lost Levels, which I'd seen at Somerset House. So Now Play This is a game festival that happens every year at Somerset House, and I'd seen The Lost Levels. And then being intrigued by that, I went and read See You Later. And so even the title of the work, it's the last message that Dan's brother sent to him.
Oh, right, yeah.
Before he died. It's an emotional work. And interestingly, it goes through the night of the bombing and Dan's personal experiences of that night, not knowing what's happened, whether his brother is one of the deceased, going through all his thought processes. So it literally, it covers quite a short time span, but you can't go backwards. So Dan has deliberately written this work in a way that whatever choice you make, whether you choose to go in the police car or to speak to your family or whatever you do in the work, you kind of have to stick to your choice. Whereas with many Twine games, you can go backwards and forwards. A bit like you mentioned, Choose Your Own Adventure books, where you could sneak back and go back.
Yeah, key your finger in the page type thing.
Yeah, exactly. But with See You Later, you have to stick to your decisions, and that's part of the work. So I've kind of picked this because quite often people think with games, I'd like to say probably people outside of the video game world, people who are not probably games players or that familiar, think it's all kind of maybe fun and quite frivolous topics. But actually, there's many, many thoughtful and thought-provoking and serious and topical works. And so I really wanted to include this because it's challenging. But it's challenging in a really interesting and thought-provoking way.
Yeah, incredible. you know, sometimes I suppose with these very difficult subjects, there's a game that's just come out on PlayStation 5 and PC called, I think it's The Light and the Darkness, which is about the Holocaust. There can be a bit of trepidation because, like you say, games are often seen as quite frivolous things, as quite playful, or maybe the idea that because players have agency, perhaps you can make decisions that will avert disaster or tragedy. And so perhaps they're not always used, but you need quite a literate creator to be able to do it in a sensitive way. I suppose Dan's got that, you know, it's his story as much as anything, isn't it?
So. Yeah. I think the kind of, because it's autobiographical, I'm quite interested. So I picked 80 Days because it's a literary adaptation, but I picked See You Later because it's an autobiographical hypertext.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So you graduate and get your MA, and then you work as a curator of maps at the National Library of Scotland. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm an assistant map curator.
So what sort of maps did you have there?
Oh gosh, everything. Again, legal deposit. With legal deposit, that means National Libraries collect cartographic items as well. Mm. So I would be cataloguing a lot of contemporary mapping. So this was kind of the days pre-smartphone. I sound so old, but obviously lots of A to Zs and road atlases and all sorts of mapping was coming in. Mm-hmm. And I would catalogue those, but also maps in other languages. And my favourite maps were actually fictional maps. So if you get Star Trek maps or Winnie the Pooh, 100 Acre Wood, you know what I mean? You'd get all sorts of fictional maps coming in, but anything...
But is that ones that just the public have made or ones that are coming from the creators of those works?
So we're talking that the publishers would send them in under UK legal deposits. So these are what publishers are depositing. I also got to work on early digitization projects when I was at National Library of Scotland. So full kudos to National Library of Scotland. They've been digitizing their map collections for a very long time now. Lots of people use their historic ordnance survey maps that are on their website. But I was fortunate to be involved in their kind of early digitization projects, which are really impressive.
Yeah, that's so interesting. There's a lot of interest around video game world maps, I would say, at the moment. There's a book recently out from Read Only Memory called, I think, An Atlas of Interactivity, something like that. You can search it up anywhere listening.
That's gone to the library. I hope the publishers have sent copies.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. There is a lot of interest in the kind of maps on video games. And like I say, with 80 Days, we did put an image of the roots. Maps and games just really go together. Absolutely.
How does it work when these are obviously fictional places and you're saying that some of them get deposited in national libraries? Is that based on the nationality of the creator of the work? So like with A.A. Milne's and 100 Acre Wood, is that...
Well, with traditional publications, it would be based on place of publication.
I see.
Okay. So it gets more complicated with digital.
All right.
But with the material that I'm talking that came in there, it would be the place of publication of the items. So items out of the UK would be probably acquired by purchase rather than legal deposit, because you're trying to collect the publishing output of the United Kingdom.
This is quite a technical question, but then I suppose, you know... Let's say Nintendo publishes Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom in the UK. Would you be able to put the Put the map from that games?
It would all depends what's in scope. But like I say, we're looking at what we consider publications. And again, with Zelda, if they made a book of the images from Zelda and published that in the UK,
that's going in.
That would be in scope of UK legal deposit.
Yeah, it makes sense. Interesting. Okay, let's come to your third game then, which is from May 2019. Do you want to tell us about this one?
My third game is Astrologaster by Niam Niam.
Long ago in England in 1592, there begins our tale, and all of it is true. Through the whole of London, bubonic plague it spread, covering folk in weeping sores and leaving thousands dead.
From towns and cities, doctors they did flee, leaving their patients to die in misery.
But one brave doctor stayed when all the cowards fled. Might not have been because he was too sick to leave his bed.
Ford made a plague cure and used it on himself, then left his house to raise all bugbears to health.
Huzzah! Huzzah! Huzzah!
I love this game. So Astrologaster is, again, in the digital storytelling exhibition at the British Library, and you can play this game and see it projected on a wall. What I really like about this work is it's based on a real historical character. So Simon Forman, he is infamous, a bit of a John Dee type character. So this is an Elizabethan medical comedy. What I love is it looks like the design of it is like a digital pop-up book, and you turn the virtual pages and they pop up, and patients visit Simon Forman, and I suppose the aim of the game is to collect letters of recommendation. So patients will come and see you, and you then consult the stars and try to help them with their problems. They might be medical problems, or they might be more personal problems. And if they're happy with you, they'll write you a letter of support, and many come back for repeat visits. One of the fun things that I really, really enjoy, though, is that little summaries of each patient and what's wrong with them are sung at you as madrigals. And I was very keen. I'm probably upsetting a lot of visitors to the gallery, but I was very keen that we have the songs as kind of audio, not on headphones, in the gallery, so people could hear these songs, because I just find them so delightful. And we're having the singers coming into the library to perform them live on the 15th of September.
Oh, amazing.
So if anyone's a kind of Astrologaster fan and loves the soundtrack as much as I do, yeah, and they can come along to the library on the 15th of September, then, like I say, we'll be having the soundtrack sung at the library.
Oh, so cool. So are they singing that in English or in Latin? Or?
In English. So the songs are in English.
Okay. So you can hear they're singing about the symptoms, aren't they?
Absolutely, they're very funny. They're quite rude and quite funny. What I should also mention is Astrologaster has been a kind of collaboration between the game studio and historians from Cambridge University. The historical research team at Cambridge University digitized manuscripts. So the real kind of manuscripts from Simon Forman are in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, but they've been digitized by Cambridge, and the historians work with the game developer. So I've loved this, the fact that you've had historical archives being used by a contemporary game studio to make quite a really quirky comedy game, but based on accurate records that are in the archive.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, this is definitely like an area of interest for you, isn't it? The use of real historical sources and documents and how we can use those in digital reinterpretations, I suppose. What was it that first got you into that area?
This is quite a long, convoluted story, but I first got interested in this because I went to a digital preservation conference, but I met two individuals, Ian Simons and James Newman, who founded National Video Game Museum that's in Sheffield. But this was before they had the museum in Sheffield. This was a long time ago. So they were talking to me about the work that they were doing archiving games and their interests. But But they mentioned, so at the time, they Ian Simons was running a festival called Game City Festival.
Yeah, in Nottingham.
In Nottingham. So Ian Simons, who runs Game City Festival, mentioned to me that he was interested in running a competition for students, a game-making competition, but he was kind of thinking about whether it should have a theme or whether there could be a kind of focus for this, because just setting a challenge to students make a game and it being very open and generic was probably not that helpful. So it was actually Ian and James that asked me, could British Library collections be used by students making games? And at the time, so this was back
amazing.
This was back in 2012, I said I didn't know. I encouraged, I was going to say coerced, but I think encouraged is a better word, my colleague Tom Harper, who's antiquarian maps curator at the British Library, to work with me. And we came up with some themes for a competition. And the first competition we did, Set the Great Fire of London, I was just gobsmacked by the quality of the winning game that year by Pudding Lane Productions. They did a kind of walk-in simulator of walking around London before the Great Fire, and it was just so amazing. For me, that proved what you could do, and definitely that, like you say, library and archive collections could be used in this way.
Well, what were they drawing from then to recreate London that's in the collection?
We picked several maps out, including, I remember, a very detailed Visher map. I would normally have these in front of me to look at, but it's been a while ago. But I do remember that this had got a detailed depiction of London Bridge. So we're talking the original London Bridge that doesn't exist anymore.
Yep.
It included the heads on spikes and all sorts of detail. But we provided also a map of the damaged area after the Great Fire of London. So the students could see the area that was covered, and that's the area that they made of their walk-in simulator. But they did that area before the fire had happened. So we provided a range of digitized maps and views.
Oh, so interesting.
From the 17th century.
Yeah.
Let's inform this.
Samuel Pepys wrote a lot, didn't he, in his diary about what London was like around that
he did.
Specific time. Yeah.
What I found very interesting is the students went and visited the Shambles in York.
Yes.
And they measured the width of the streets. I was really impressed with the research and detail that they went into to make their interactive walk-in sim game.
Yeah.
They also made the streets of houses modular so that they could have different tops, middles and bottoms of the houses. And that's how they could make so many streets and make them look different. But they did a fantastic amount of research, like I say, using the digitized maps, but also going and doing site visits to historical areas to look at street widths. And yeah, that level of detail, super impressive.
How interesting. That's amazing. Yeah, that modular architectural techniques used by big game studios as well, isn't it? You know, bits of castles that they can then arrange to create unique buildings very quickly.
Absolutely. It's really kind of fascinating and clever. Yeah.
So what sort of, you know, watching some of these experiments over the last few years that you've seen game studios coming in and trying to work with some of these collections, what are some of the lessons that you've learned through that? What I suppose maybe best practice, or what things particularly always work well, do you think?
Lesson that I learned early on, especially from my point of view, is to provide materials that are either public domain or cleared for Creative Commons.
Right.
So they're available for reuse. And so it's a kind of rights clearance. That's a bit of a boring issue, but super important.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's having meaningful discussions and thinking through what would make a good game. And I know, so the competition that I ran had different themes in different years. We had a Shakespearean one, we had an Alice's Adventures in Wonderland one. We picked different topics, but I suppose it's working with the creators to find what they might find interesting and useful.
Yeah.
But I do think with cultural heritage organisations, by making out of copyright digitised collections openly available for creative reuse, that's going to encourage people to do things that you can't even predict.
Yes, right.
Yeah. And that's where it gets exciting.
Yeah.
It's like sometimes I've discovered examples of creative reuse that we've not instigated, but they've just happened. So there's... this is an analog game rather than a video game, so I don't know whether it's in scope for your podcast, Simon.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, go for it.
There's a card game called Great Scott. That's used digitized book illustrations, but it's a quirky card game about and where you make up. It's kind of like a storytelling game where you make up fantastical inventions and have to describe them. But each card is basically reused book illustrations from the British Library's Flickr account.
Oh, cool. Right.
But we didn't instigate this card game. Sinister Fish Games just went and made it. But by putting digital collections out there, people can do all sorts of things, and it is just exciting to see what they do.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. I mean, so much of the world and the creative assets are owned by companies and corporations, so it's so lovely to have some things that people can experiment with and reshape and remix, isn't it? On that topic, the game preservation, which you touched on briefly with Ian Simon's work and his colleagues, it's such a hot topic at the moment, isn't it? How do we preserve these digital artifacts, video games, things like that? And I had Kelsey Lewin on from the Video Game Foundation, and she was talking about the work that organisation does to try and preserve the stories around the creation of games. But I suppose another challenge is, we've been talking about video game virtual worlds and virtual maps and things like that. If you look at games like Fortnite or Call of Duty Warzone, or even, I suppose these expansive environments that people become very attached to and very familiar with, but then they just disappear because one day Epic Games might decide, oh, we're going to drop a new map for Fortnite and the old one is now gone. And there's no way to visit it. Perhaps you can go on YouTube and see a clip of it, but it's just a vanished world. Is there anything we can do about that?
I do think companies themselves need to engage more with archive in their own works. And this could have value for them. So Nintendo, you mentioned Nintendo earlier. Nintendo were actually very good at archiving their back catalogue because I think they see, obviously, commercial benefit in reusing it in the future. But I really do think the games industry as a whole needs to actively engage in digital preservation. There seems to be quite a focus on the next game out and the next. Everything's all about the next title, the next game. But I really do think the industry needs to work with digital preservation partners. There are digital preservation organisations such as the Digital Preservation Coalition. It's a membership organisation, so anyone can join. Commercial partners can join just as much as archives and libraries and museums can. But it would be really welcome if some of the big game studios and publishers did want to participate, because we can't solve all these challenges on our own.
Yeah.
It's only really by collaboration and partnership that you can really make progress in this area.
Mm.
I've mentioned web archiving before. So at the British Library, we've been making quite a lot of progress with using different types of web crawler to experiment with capturing interactive websites.
Mm.
And we've been using a crawler called Conifer. So anyone interested in digital art might know about Rhizome and the work they do with collecting digital art. But the browser that's been developed for that can also be used for interactive fiction. So that's what we've been trying it with. But where we've also made progress is by working with studios. So working with Inkle to collect 80 days and having this meaningful working out how we can collect it. Often it's easier for us to collect, say, the source code for PC rather than, say, anything app-based, but it's working out what's possible and doing it in collaboration. But I think industry definitely needs to try to engage with and work with other partners to try to preserve things. You've mentioned video playthroughs, and that's something that we're really looking at the moment. And I know it's not quite the same as preserving an actual virtual world. It's not the same, but preserving playthroughs is at least it's some step of trying to capture something. So we're calling this enhanced curation.
Okay.
And we do have a few. We've made three playthrough videos that we've got in the digital storytelling exhibition at the library. We've worked with a PhD student to make these, and the aim is not only will they help the interpretation in the gallery for people who might not have played these games before. So we've made them for 80 days, we've made one for Astrologaster, and we've made one for Wolves in the Walls.
Okay.
But we're hoping that if we add these playthrough videos into the library's collections, that say researchers in the future, if these works don't exist, they can watch a playthrough, at least it provides some sort of understanding of these works.
What it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
How interesting. Well, you've mentions your fourth title there, so it seems like a good time to
come
to
it. Is that a good segue?
Good segue, yeah. Tell us about this one.
So Wolves in the Walls is my fourth choice.
You heard it too. You do, don't you? Hello. But up here, in the attic, the sounds were the loudest, especially in the dark. You did it! You got proof! We have to go show Mom.
You think there's what in the walls, dear?
Wolves.
Who told you there were wolves in the walls, Pig Puppet?
No, but we heard them.
It can't be wolves, Loopy.
Did you see that?
It can't possibly be wolves.
Because you know what they say.
When the wolves come out of the walls,
it's all over.
Everybody knows this.
You believe me, don't you?
So this is another literary adaptation based on the children's book by Neil Gaiman and Dave McKean. And it's created by Fable for virtual reality, so for the Rift. What I liked about this is so you interact with Lucy, who's the main character. She can see wolves here and see wolves in the walls of her house, but her family can't.
No.
So you enter the game, and it's really quite sweet how you enter the game. You draw around your hand in chalk and then you enter the world. You're there to be, I suppose, confident might feel a wrong word. I don't know, join Lucy in trying to navigate with her family what's going on. But what I really like in this story is there's activities in the book that obviously if you're reading a picture book, you can't do those activities. But in the VR game, you can take pictures with the Polaroid camera. There's a colouring in activity. So you get to do virtual colouring in with Lucy. You get to help her mum make jam. And I just kind of, it's quite gentle in a way. And I really picked this because I thought there might be people interested in VR, but not quite understanding whether it's for them. And I thought that this is quite a gentle, okay, it's got a bit of a sinister edge. I'm not, but this kind of adaptation of a children's book, many people would be familiar with the narrative from the book, or they might have gone and seen the theatrical production, and because they having it in VR is just a really interesting new development for this story.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I have to say I haven't played it. It's only available in VR, is it?
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's in three chapters, but it's right. Yeah, on the Rift.
So you mentioned earlier that you're co-creator of this new exhibition called Digital Storytelling, which runs from June through to October. Did you say?
Yep. So yeah, digital storytelling runs until the 15th of October.
And it's, you're sort of, I suppose, the premises that you evolve, exploring how evolving technologies have changed how writers write and how readers read, which is why video games are included. How did you go about choosing, you know, what to put in?
That's a good question. So like I say, we've been really focusing on works that we've been collecting in the library, or where we've been working with the writers and working with the creatives, that we works that we feel are in scope for UK legal deposit, and we've been collaborating, and we really wanted to showcase the progress that we've made with this research so far. But we also wanted to show a different, I suppose, the kind of diversity of voices and diversity of technology. So we were very keen to try to have something for everybody. There's some quite literary works in the exhibition. We've worked with poets, so poets such as J.R. Carpenter, whose work This Is a Picture of Wind is in there. You probably wouldn't call it a video game. It's more of an interactive browser-based weather poem.
Right.
So J.R. Carpenter calls it a weather poem for phones, and it uses weather data to give you dynamic poetry.
Amazing.
So we've picked a range of works to show how writers are using technology in different ways. Can be quite creepy. There's a ghost story in the exhibition called Breathe by Kate Pullinger, So this is kind of a personalized ghost story. It uses location data, it uses weather data. If you read it at home, it takes a photo of your environment, but we've turned the camera off in the gallery. We thought there might be issues if people ended up taking photos of other people in a gallery environment. But Kate Pullidge has really used these almost like surveillance technologies in a creative way for a writer to produce a ghost story that kind of follows you around.
Very cool.
So I mean, it's great to see how the British Library is embracing video games. I would say that cultural institutions, maybe particularly in the UK, have been quite resistant, you know, to celebrating video games as works, and certainly as literary works. That's something that we haven't seen much of. Game City is probably one of the few places, exceptions to that. But, you know, it's great to see such a storied institution like the British Library doing that. But why do you think there has been this resistance historically?
I think there's been a lot of progress, certainly in the last 10 years. So as I mentioned, I first met folks working with games in 2012. I think there's been an increasing amount of interest and of respect, and things have been really flipping around. So I've mentioned Now Play This, where I first encountered Dan Hett's work.
Yes.
Been working with Bournemouth University, who run the New Media Writing Prize, and they've been running this for over 10 years.
Yes.
So I think there has been progress and things are moving on in the right direction.
Good.
And I think with any kind of new media, I'm sure film had the same issues when film was new. It takes a little time. What's quite exciting with the digital storytelling exhibition is that we're working with all of the writers to display their works. And I can't think of another exhibition that we've had at the library where literally it's all been living writers that are being displayed and we're working with them. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, very exciting. Yeah. Are you commemorating this exhibition in any way? Is there sort of a book that's collecting what happened here, or?
We're not producing, but we will be blogging. We're having an events season to accompany the exhibition.
Right.
So we're having a conference on the 7th of July, quite a scholarly conference, but writers are coming in to talk about their works and academics. And we've got some kind of playful events. I've mentioned the singers from Astrologaster are coming in on the 15th of September, but we're having a steampunk late party on Friday, the 13th of October. Clockwork Watch is one of the story worlds that's in the digital storytelling exhibition, mostly told through live action role play, theatrical style events and graphic novels. But we're doing an event with them. And we're also showcasing 19th century Minecraft. I'm working with academics at Lancaster University. We're building a Sherlock Holmes 19th century London in Minecraft. So we're going to have that at the Steampunk Late on Friday, the 13th of October. So not a book, but an event season.
Lots of other things, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if people want to know how to get along to some of those events, do they just hop on the British Library website?
Hop on the British Library website, click on digital storytelling, and then there's a page that links to the digital storytelling events as well.
Wonderful. Well, this seems like a good time to come to your fifth and your final choice. Tell us about this one.
So my final choice is the British Library Simulator by my colleague, Julia Carla Rossi.
British Library Simulator is a short browser-based game I created during the 2020 lockdown using Bitsy, a free game engine developed by Adam Ledoux. In the game, players wander around a virtual pixelated version of the library building in St. Pancras, encountering different characters on their way to the reading room. The British Library Simulator was created as a fun way to engage with our audience during the pandemic. To provide an example of the interactive narratives the library is collecting as part of our work on emerging formats, and to make the public aware of the services that we continue to provide even during lockdown, by highlighting the digital content that could be accessed from home.
A And I've picked this. So Julia made basically like a miniature pixelated British Library using Bitsy. So Bitsy, again, is another free online tool for that people can use to make games. It's often used in game jams, a bit like how Twine is as well. And you can make these very cute mini games, often with like a quite limited colour palette. You make brights and you can navigate different environments. It looks very retro. So I was speaking earlier about my childhood and how that was kind of retro. Games that people make with Bitsy these days do look quite retro.
It looks like a Game Boy type. It's a very limited colour palette and pixel art.
And a bit blocky. Yeah, absolutely, pixel art. But you could do some quite fun things. And so Julia's built a miniature British Library. You start on the piazza. So if anyone's been to the British Library, we've got this nice square in front of the library with a statue of Newton. You can go on a virtual tour of the library, experience all the things that you can on site, including queuing to get in the morning. It's quite funny.
Having your bag checked.
Having your bag checked. Exactly. You go in and buying a coffee, going to the information desk. But you can learn some facts about the British Library and do a little virtual tour. And it was just quite simple and quite playful. But Julia made this during the first COVID lockdown in 2020. And when we couldn't go on site into the library, we thought it was a nice way to, I suppose, kind of share this with the world. People can't visit us in person, but maybe they can visit us virtually.
Yeah.
And made this work. And it really is just quite delightful.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, I had a play of it. It's very sweet. Can you get into the reading rooms in the game?
I would need to check again. I know you can talk about, I know you can talk. Someone did ask whether you could go into the basements and you can't get into the basements. But obviously, if you visited the British Library in St. Pancras, you wouldn't be able to get to the basements.
Yeah. Well, you can only get in the reading rooms if you've got to sign up for a card and take two forms of ID and all of that.
Reader registration, absolutely. So you need to go to reader registration and become a reader. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, that people can play that game and plan their visit to your exhibition then, can't they? And to figure out the layout of the real library for when they get there.
It's quite easy to find the exhibition galleries. They're kind of straight there when you go in.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's have a look at your console then. So we've got 80 Days, See You Later, Astrologaster, Wolves in the Walls, and the British Library Simulator. Very on brand, very good. And we need a name for your console to market to the world. What would you like to call it, Stella?
I'd like to call my console Bookshelf Portal.
Very nice.
Feels a bit cheesy, but I really do feel that libraries, they really are portals to new worlds.
Yeah.
Within books, you can travel the world and travel back in time. And obviously, you can do that with video games. So I've mentioned with the examples, 80 Days, traveling the world with Phileas Fogg.
Brilliant.
Or Astrologaster, where you can go back to Elizabethan times with Simon Foreman. So I know portals are a bit of a cliche in the world of video games, but I thought it'd be a good title for my...
Yeah. Well, there hasn't been a console with the word portal in it for sure. So
they're not. I thought there might have been. So I thought, oh no, does everyone kind of portal in their title? So I'm glad there hasn't.
Okay, just before I let you go, Stella, I have to say one of my favourite rooms in the British Library is the, is it known as the Treasures Room or the Room of Treasures or something like that anyway? You sort of go in and under glass, they've got all these amazing literary things like Jane Austen's writing desk, I think, is in there. And they've got some of the earliest manuscripts from Shakespeare. What's your recommendation that a visitor goes and looks at in that room? Have you got a favourite artefact?
I probably don't have a favourite. And you mentioned Jane Austen's writing desk. What I was going to mention is some of our treasures have been digitised in 3D.
Oh, they have?
And they're on Sketchfab. So you can go and rotate and move them around. What I do like is we've got an amazing collection of globes, including celestial globes. And these have been, like I say, digitised in 3D. And so you can virtually spin them. So if you go on the British Library's website and look at our historic globes collections, you can virtually spin them. Often there is at least one globe in the Treasures Gallery, but obviously in the gallery, you can't go and spin that because things are behind glass. So I think for me, it's like when you can digitise treasures, and especially if they're 3D objects, and then you can manipulate the 3D object.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Can you go, just a quick question on the Jane Austen's desk that you digitise. Is that something that people could theoretically download and put in their own game?
I would have to check the rights. So on the rights information, I'd have to check on Sketchfab because they've all been released under different licences.
Okay, but it might be possible.
Absolutely. And what I'm hoping in the future is the library does more 3D digitization, that if people did want to use the 3D models in creative ways to contact the library, I would absolutely love to see the models used in interactive virtual environments and video games. That would be a dream. I know there is a market for Jane Austen games. I don't know whether you've heard of the game Ever Jane.
I haven't, no.
You've not heard of Ever Jane? There's two. Oh, I won't go into this, but I have had speakers from Ever Jane come and speak at events in the library before. But no, there's a whole world of Jane Austen games out there.
That's so cool. Well, we can hopefully expect to see Jane Austen's desk in, Kratos's, heart or something in God of War. That would be quite funny.
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. Well, Stella, this has been great. Thank you so much for chatting to me. And I'm sure lots of people who listen to this will get along and see the new exhibition. So thank you.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you so much to my guest, Stella Wisdom. The Digital Storytelling Exhibition is now on at the British Library. So that's the British Library. You can get to it by taking the tube to King's Cross. It's a short walk from there. If you've not visited before, you should definitely do that. It's a great place to take your laptop or a bit of paper and do some writing or just wander around. It's got a lovely atmosphere there. Big, open, spacious. As you heard in our discussion there, you need a reader's ticket if you want to get into the reading rooms, which are really quiet, where you can get lots of work done. But you can also just sit in the main foyer. There's loads of tables and chairs and things. Good place to work. The Digital Storytelling Exhibition is open until Sunday the 15th of October 2023. It costs £9 for a full price ticket. If you're a member, you get in for free. If you're over the age of 60, it's £4.50. If you're a young person, if you're a child between the ages of 0 and 11, you get in for free. If you're 12 to 17, it's £4.50. Or if you're 18 to 25, it's also £4.50. You can go and play some of the games that are on display there. So some of them have been released, like 80 Days, an absolute stone cold classic, which you should download immediately for your phone or your PC and play that. Some of them are yet to be released. For example, Shella Ramanan, the previous My Perfect Console guest, the game she's working on, Windrush Tales, that is, I think, playable or at least viewable at the exhibition. So get yourself along. Take a look at that. I appreciate that this is quite London-centric, and well, we've had quite a few London-centric episodes, so we'll try and do some speak to some guests from some other parts of the UK as well in coming weeks. In fact, I've recorded a couple, so never fear if you live in the north or somewhere else. We'll be expanding the geography, the range of My Perfect Console's guests in coming weeks. But for anyone who can get to London, or if you're doing a day trip, or if you live there already, get along to the British Library's Digital Storytelling Exhibition. You may have noticed there a returning appearance from my dear friend Ed Hawkins, the opera singer. Of course, Dan Hetz, game seer later, does not have any audio or music as far as I'm aware. And so, yes, we just did the same trick from the Sam Barlow episode last week, whereby I asked Ed to record some of the lines from Dan's wonderful and moving game. So thank you to Ed for doing that. If you want to find out more about Ed, you can visit his website, edwardhawkinsbass.com. If you're making a video game and you're looking for a voice actor, lots of video voice actors listen to this podcast, and I'm sure they would be only too glad to chat to you about making an appearance. Ed, I know, would be up for doing that. What an incredible voice he's got, so why not drop him a line through his website if you are looking for someone to lend a deep, gravelly voice to your video game. Thank you, Ed. Thank you as well to those of you who have written to me. Many of you loved last week's episode with Sam Barlow, which is great. Lots of interactive fiction fans writing, saying how pleased they were to hear Sam discuss some of those little or lesser known titles from the 80s. If you go onto the My Perfect Console Twitter, I put up some links for where you can play some of Sam's choices. Some of them are available free on the internet. You can just go along and Mind Forever Voyaging. For example, it's on there. Portal and Isle, three of the games that Sam picked, are all available to play online. And you can just go on Twitter and find the links there. Click through and have a go of those games if you'd like to. Yeah, and thank you for all your kind comments. Many of you have written in to say how much you enjoyed that, and even people who had no interest in text adventures or interactive fiction writing in to say that they found Sam's description of those games and the appeal that they held for him extremely compelling. So yeah, thank you. It's nice, isn't it? Got loads of diversity. I think Stella's choices as well this week, very different range of games to some of the others that we've had on here. It just shows the breadth and variety in the video game medium, doesn't it? It's not all FIFA and Call of Duty, although of course there's nothing wrong with those games either. Don't come at me, Activision or EA. I've been playing Armored Core 6, the new game from Software, Hidetaka Miyazaki's studio that he is now director of in Japan. Lots of guests have picked the Dark Souls games and games in that series before. Armored Core is a return to From Software's early roots. That was the game series that they were making early on. You sort of bipedal tanks, mecha, as they're known in anime, fighting one another, all of that. It's really hard. Oh my gosh, I got stuck so many times. But a pretty spectacular game as well at the same time. But yeah, much more old school, I would say, than the Souls series. Anyway, I'm playing that at the moment. That's why I bring it up. If you're interested in seeing which guests have been on the show, what games they've chosen and how they've chosen to name their consoles, you can do that by visiting the My Perfect Console spreadsheet Royale, which lists all of the guests and their games and also has links to the episodes and all sorts of things. If you head to the Patreon page, so that's patreon.com/myperfectconsole, then you will see I've got it pinned at the top and you can just click on there and you can have a little read. If you want to editing permissions, just request them and then you can pitch in with adding information and data as and when it comes up. An interesting little thing to read at. Maybe we'll do some like infographics at the end of the year or something. We'll see. See what happens. But anyway, it's good that we're collating that information for quick reference, and you can also sort to see what the most chosen games have been and all of that. Speaking of Patreon, if you'd like to support the podcast, then just head along there, become a supporter, and you will get lots of benefits. You get your episodes early and ad free, you get to join in with the community, you get previews of who the guests are going to be a month in advance. And you get some bonus content. I'm going to be trying out some, I have been recording little bonus interviews with some of the guests with questions suggested by Patreon supporters. Those will be coming out soon. I'm also going to be trialing some other bonus episode content. For example, in September, I'll be attending the Tokyo Game Show. I'm thinking of maybe just doing a little episode from there, just wandering around, telling you what I can see there. TGS is something that's quite difficult to get to, so because I'll be there, maybe I'll share some of that info. Anyway, we'll do some experiments, see what works, what doesn't, what people enjoy, all of that stuff. Either way, it would be great to have you as a supporter to help the podcast grow and keep going. And as ever, please subscribe, leave a review, tell your friends. That would be great. Okay, I think that's probably enough from me for now. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Something a little bit different there, but great to hear from a wonderful British institution about how they are working with and investigating, exploring and reinterpreting video game material. Wonderful to see the National Library doing that. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. If you are a game maker and you'd like the British Library to have a copy of your game, then investigate that. Stella gave out the link. So go on to that part of the website and yes, submit your stuff. If you work for a big company, you should be doing that too. Yeah, it's great if this stuff is archived, because the video game industry is not good at upholding and looking after its past, as we've discussed lots in previous episodes. So yeah, if you work for one of the big companies and you'd like to see your work preserved in the library, that is a great way to do it. Get in contact with Stella or the team there and see how you can partner. Okay, I will be back again next week with another guest. There are five choices and one more perfect console. Till then, goodbye.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.